It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Some vertical farms face economic troubles. We assess the challenges and opportunities of vertical farming in Wisconsin with LED grow lights and nutrient solutions, green stacked on vertical shelves, no soil. Call in with your questions about this type of farming, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Ernst is founder of Ernesse Farms in Ripon. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a little bit of a taste of your operation here, a vision in our mind's eye. Walk us through your operation.
Yeah, so we just recently expanded into a former grocery store. Our grow operation is 21,000 square feet. Our main grow room, we are able to stack our grow levels on top of each other, and we're able to go seven layers high. And so all of our crops are grown hydroponically. So we use no soil. All the plants receive their nutrients through a customized nutrient solution that I developed. And one of the great things about our operation is obviously we don't have to worry about growing seasons. And so right now where it's freezing cold outside, and a couple of days ago when we had, 7 inches of snow, we're out here still producing basil and other culinary herbs, mushrooms, microgreens, and we're able to do that year round.
Isn't it ironic you're in an old grocery store?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the best parts about it is when I was in high school, this used to be a Piggly Wiggly and I used to work here. And so now we own the building and we crawl our plants here. So
your life is coming
good circle,
full
yeah.
circle.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So you produce, herbs, microgreens, you've got mushrooms going on. How do you decide what to grow?
Whatever the demand is. And so, one of the things with vertical farming, obviously, you kind of hinted at it in your intro there. There's a steep upfront cost to getting to the market. And so we typically try to pick products that are, have a little bit higher selling price to justify all of those inputs that we have to put in. But there are just certain types of plants and crops that are really well suited to be grown indoors.
So what are those upfront costs like? I mean, in terms of the grow lights and the solutions and the shelving and warehousing and energy to keep it all going. What is the impact?
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely a steep upfront cost getting into the industry, right? And so obviously, we're not able to provide all that sunshine that regular agriculture and other CEA operations get for free. Now, that can be a problem, or it could also be a benefit. And so with our grow lights, we have them custom made for us. And so we give the plants only certain wavelengths of light that they actually need for photosynthesis. So we save electricity that way. But it's certainly a energy intensive industry, right? And so even though we're here in Wisconsin, it's cold outside. Well, in order to grow inside, we still have to regulate all those temperatures. And so, we have obviously elevated HVAC costs and dehumidity pieces of equipment that we need to be using. But all in, when you look at the other inputs that traditional agriculture has, right, the amount of fuel for the tractors and all the transport distances, it's really, a wash. The problem is, with our industry, the costs are up front rather than really, as much ongoing throughout the season.
Talking about indoor farming with Brian Ernst, indoor farmer based in Ripon, you can join the conversation with your questions and your experiences growing indoors. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian, you mentioned you created a specific nutrient solution that works for your indoor farming needs. And I'm just curious, how much tech or computer-aided devices are in your operation to, adjust lights and adjust temperature and, humidity, other things to optimize growing?
Yeah, we try to optimize absolutely everything we do, right? And so, again, we don't have some of those benefits that they have out in nature, right, with positive airflow and nice warm temperatures. And so we use a ton of sensors, a ton of automation. Some of the stuff we purchase from other companies, but the majority of it is stuff that we've developed in-house. And so when we started the company 7 years ago, or almost 8 years ago now, You know, a lot of the stuff didn't exist. It was a very new industry. So CEA, or controlled environmental agriculture, has been around for a while. So you think greenhouses and even hydroponic growing has been around for a while. But the idea of stacking all those grow levels on top of each other indoors is relatively new. And so when we first started the business, we had to develop a lot of the stuff ourselves. And so, you know, we bought 3D printers, I taught myself CAD and programming, and we just went out and, you know, if something didn't exist, we had to make it. And so we try to automate as much as we possibly can here to remain efficient and competitive with other field grown products.
Where do you find your customers?
So our first customers were Festival Foods and some other smaller local grocery stores. And it was really just getting out there, beating the pavement and meeting with produce managers and explaining why our products were better, and, you know, explain that we weren't going to have the supply issues that traditional agriculture would have. And, you know, once we got into a few grocery stores, it really took off from there when word was able to spread to the other produce managers about our products.
What about organic or non-genetically modified seeds? How does that work in vertical farming applications?
Yeah, so you can still use soil in traditional, or I'm sorry, in vertical farming. You know, we find that it allows more or an increased likelihood that you could have types of contamination. And so that's one of the reasons why we choose to go strictly hydroponic and use no soil, right? And so we are able to nearly eliminate any risk of Listeria or E. coli into our system simply by not using the soil. Now, there are still ways to organically hydroponically grow your product. But, you know, we're reaching that point in the industry where I think consumers are getting a little, tired or exhausted from seeing everything labeled as organic. And especially when some of the things that people buy in the stores are being labeled organic, but they're coming from Colombia or they're coming from Thailand, it really kind of calls into question the certification process. And so, you know, we're kind of entering this post-organic part of our business operation where consumers are just more concerned with knowing where their food comes from and how it's grown. And so while there is nothing wrong with genetically modified seeds, you know, we don't use any genetically modified seeds, no herbicides, pesticides. I would even argue that we follow the organic certification stricter than, you know, some organic growers. And so just letting customers know that that's how we grow the product and where it's coming from, and that it's, you know, fresh. We deliver all of our stuff next day after it's harvested. You know, that's going to be more important than just a logo on a label.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's bring on a call. John in Richland Center. John, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yeah, I would like to ask Brian about his light bill, because the advent of LED lights, you can save 90%, and he has 140,000 square feet of growing space. And the spectrum is white light, red light, and ultraviolet. Where does the LED lights fall in?
John, thank you. Brian.
Yeah, so all of our lights that we use are custom LED lights. And so we're only giving the plants certain wavelengths of light that they need, which happen to fall into the red and the blue spectra. And so, you know, we give those our plants at certain wavelengths and a specific ratio as a way to trick the plants into constantly thinking it's spring. So we refer to that as biomimicry, right? And so we're always trying to trick the plants into thinking it's spring, whereas on the other side of our building, when we're growing the mushrooms, we're always trying to trick the mushrooms into thinking it's fall. And so we definitely see a lot of energy savings using the LED lights. However, I mean, it's definitely a lot of energy input. And so in our grow room alone, we probably have over 3,000 LED grow lights. And so, and those, while they are more efficient, still produce quite a bit of heat that does have to be reused. And so we try to duct that throughout the building to save on other energy costs. And so there's still a little bit of a technological leap that has to happen there to make LEDs a little more efficient, a little more cheaper, and to, you know, bring some of those other associated costs that most people don't think of, like the HVAC costs that play into it. You know, if we can get those down, then it'll really take off, I think.
Brian Ernst founded a vertical farming operation 8 years ago in Ripon. Colin, with your questions about the expanding indoor farming industry, what vertical farming means for our state, the number to join in with your questions and comments, it's 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the innovations and the challenges of growing crops vertically indoors in less space and no soil, and what it means for Wisconsin ag moving forward. Thanks to Nina in Madison for suggesting we discuss vertical farming during a caller-only program, telling us what she hopes to grow.
Strawberries and fruits and vegetables and other healthy foods that can possibly be given out on a large scale to people in need.
And thanks to Jeff in Superior, who echoed sentiment having been on a tour of a farm in Ashland. Colin, with your questions, your comments about vertical farming, 800-642-1234. Brian Ernst runs an indoor farm in Ripon. Brian, let's talk about labor. As you are growing and harvesting all year long, how does the labor cost of indoor farming compare to outdoor row farms, row crops?
Yeah, so one of the technological challenges that still hasn't been solved for us is there is, there's no version of the indoor farming tractor, right? And so everything has to be harvested by hand. And so that is a high labor kind of operation. Now, we're investing in some technologies to give us some more automation that'll help with the harvesting and the packaging. But, it is a labor-heavy industry. And so thankfully, we've always been able to find enough work. I think people are real excited when they, hear about what we're doing and they see those bright pink glow of our grow lights and they want to, get in on the ground floor of a growing industry. But it's certainly, one of the challenges that, as an industry, we're still working to solve.
I wonder, is the USDA supportive of indoor farming, like with grants and cooperative agreements? What is the relationship like with federal programs?
Yeah, so again, being such a new industry, it's really taken several years for people to, start paying attention really to it. And so just in recent years, we have seen more grants by the USDA, the Farm Service Agency, towards expanding research into vertical farming, other co-ops. So there's certainly been more participation from some of those agencies than when we first started. It almost seemed, like people were kind of writing it off. And as people were able to see just how much produce that we're able to put out, they really started thinking, maybe we should start investing in some of these guys and seeing how far we can push this. And so recent years have definitely been much better for some of those programs.
You've talked about how much you've had to create on your end and invent. Do employees need higher ed or some non-traditional skills to farm indoors?
I mean, we certainly employ some more higher education individuals here. We have some biologists on our staff, but being such a new industry, we're able to really kind of train people from the ground up. And so as an industry, we're all still writing our own SOP books, right? So as technology is changing and as we try different procedures and techniques, we're able to rewrite our SOP Bibles. And the nice thing about having such a new industry and with processes constantly evolving is there really doesn't need to be, someone coming in with all kinds of technological experience. Now, certainly, I mean, it would be fantastic if we had a software engineer on staff and we do have several college students that are grad students and other computer science majors that are helping with some of those programmings. But, just anyone who has a passion for plants and has a passion for food, this is the type of industry for them.
Let's take another call now. Buzz is with us in Fish Creek. Buzz, hi.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Brian. Interesting show. What you do is amazing. I'm very much into it. You know, I thought about this for a while, and there was an interesting question previously on the LED light source, and it kind of jumped my reptilian brain to, what about HVAC? Are you guys looking at or using currently any sort of wind power or solar power kind of things to defray the cost?
Buzz, thank you. What about solar and wind in terms of energy inputs there, Brian?
Yeah, so currently we're not employing any solar or renewable energy on our roof. You know, it's definitely something we're interested in pursuing in the future. But you know, unfortunately, our energy costs are quite high, and so we would have to cover a lot more than just our roof with solar panels in order to generate enough electricity to completely pay for all of our lights. Now, I mean, any kind of offset would be beneficial, but you know, with the government grants that they have right now for solar, it's still pretty cost prohibitive. And so it's definitely something we'd be interested in pursuing in the future, though.
Talking about indoor farming with Brian Ernst, indoor farmer based in Ripon. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, what about as you looked at California and other big, big agriculture states using up a lot of land for agriculture, how are you able to find your place in agriculture, in the industry, as local indoor farms can't compete at the same scale?
Yeah, so we definitely can't compete at the same scale, but growing the majority of our nation's lettuce in California is just strictly not sustainable. You look at all the crisis they're constantly having out there with the water, constant recalls that we're having with romaine lettuces. It's just not sustainable. And so vertical farming is never going to compete with traditional agriculture crop for crop, right? So we're never going to be able to grow the nation's supply of corn. And so what vertical farming can do is we can take some of those other crops that are easy to grow, that are currently being grown in unsustainable ways out in California, right? And we can grow those close to urban centers where we won't have to deal with some of those same issues that they're having. And so then that land that is used to grow some of those other crops can then be repurposed for other things, and to grow different crops that are maybe better suited for that geographic area in the country. And so while we'll never replace traditional agriculture, vertical farming definitely has its place for growing leafy greens that just can't be competed with.
You started out by experimenting with indoor farming in your own basement before opening this operation. How will your farm fare long term? Because when I think of farming operations, I think of generations after generations.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. I always had to preface that, you know, statement when they say that you were growing hydroponically in your basement, I always had to remind them it's not that kind of basement hydroponic growing. But it was more of a research and development hydroponic growing. But yeah, that's interesting. You know, I mean, I do have three children, and they've all expressed interest in wanting to, you know, come work at the farm. And my son has come and helped on packaging day sometimes during Thanksgiving and Christmas when we've been shorthanded. But, you know, specifically my kids, they view it from an engineering standpoint. And so, you know, they get to see dad come to work every day and design stuff on his computer and print it out and then, you know, program and build robots. And so when you ask my kids, like what we do at work, and, you know, they'll say, you know, my dad makes robots at work, right? And so it's very interesting. And so as technology continues to progress, I think there's just gonna be more and more things that can be built and designed for this industry.
Okay, we're out of time, but I just have to ask you, the omakase berry, is it worth it?
Oh, absolutely not. Who wants to spend that much money on a strawberry? That is one of the challenges, right? And so you have to be able to price your products. I mean, we have people ask us all the time, can you grow this? You can grow that. And the answer is always, yeah, absolutely, I can grow that, but I'm not sure you're going to want to pay what I had to charge to make it worth it. And so finding that right balance, right, for that consumer experience and for profitability is a delicate dance for sure.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Ernst owns Ernesse Farms in Ripon. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A quick heads up on our programming here. This month, every Tuesday at 8, we're producing a series about cooking tools and kitchen appliances. Our first installment had tips for using knives and cutting boards. And next up, it's the growing popularity of air fryers. Join us for kitchen advice Tuesday mornings at 8 here on the Ideas Network. This semester's classes will be the last at the two-year University of Wisconsin campus known by locals as UW-Richland. In the 3 months since the UW system announced the news, a group of supporters has rallied to save the campus, and local officials in other parts of the state are asking whether their two-year campus might be next. Rich Kramer reports.
It was standing room only in late January in a classroom at the UW-Platteville-Richland campus. The community was there to pitch ideas on how to save the school that has seen enrollment fall to just 60 students. University officials and state lawmakers were there to listen. Like most who spoke, Alicia Woodhouse had family members attend UW-Richland. She said the thought of losing the opportunity for local kids to get a college education without spending thousands of dollars on a dorm room makes her feel sick.
First of all, I want to say how hurt I felt when I heard that this campus was closing, because it really felt like we were not worth it, like we had been discounted as a community.
Some speakers asked lawmakers to divert $4 million from the state's budget surplus to the campus. State Representative Tony Kurtz, a Republican from Waniwok, told the group he'd already mentioned the idea to some skeptical GOP colleagues.
So I am being brutally honest with you that I could probably persuade a few, but I know it would be a fruitless effort, because we would lose.
It wasn't the message community members wanted to hear, and the end of classes at Richland is already making other communities nervous. There are 12 other county-owned campuses like UW-Richland around the state, and they've all seen enrollment fall by an average of 57% over the past decade. During that time, state lawmakers cut $250 million from the UW system's budget. Since Richland's fate was announced, some county boards have delayed maintenance and upgrades at their schools. They want the UW system to promise that they won't close other campuses anytime soon. Marathon County Board Chair Kurt Gibbs says UW-Stevens Point at Wausau has been a critical source of quality education for the area, but the board is waiting for assurances before approving parts of a $6 million maintenance request.
Yeah, if the roof is leaking, we're going to fix the roof. There's no question. But when it comes to upgrading things effectively still in their life cycle, the board said, no, let's hold off.
Last month, a group of trustees made up of Outagamie and Winnebago County board members delayed a $4 million engineering study of a proposed dining facility expansion at UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities. Winnebago County Supervisor Stephen Binder told his board they need to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars.
Neither Outagamie County nor Winnebago County want to invest money in a building if we're not guaranteed that we're going to be there for at least 5 years.
UW officials say the Richland decision shouldn't be viewed as a sign of what's to come for other campuses. And Andrew Leavitt, chancellor at UW-Oshkosh, told WPR he has assured county leaders the Fox City campus isn't going away. Former UW system president Ray Cross hoped to delay these types of conversations when he merged the state's two-year and four-year campuses in 2018. The move saved money by cutting administrative staff, but that may have also come with unintended consequences. In Richland, locals say it meant the loss of their college recruiter. Cross wanted to merge the schools with the state's technical colleges, but the idea was fiercely opposed by local tech college boards. Now he says the legislature should have a conversation about making it happen.
Should we be like 95% of the rest of the states in this country and merge our technical and UW colleges? Is that the best solution? I think it is, but I doubt that they will have that conversation.
In a statement, the UW system said talks with community leaders around the state about the two-year campuses are underway. As for Richland, the statement doesn't suggest that the university will reverse its decision, but it does say a local technical college and high school could play a key role in the campus's long-term future. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you know if your child is in the right car seat and strapped in correctly? We discuss proper car seat safety and what to be aware of, as car accidents are among the most common causes of death in children. Call in with your car seat and booster seat questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Macy Williams is here, Safety Center Program Manager at Children's Wisconsin. Macy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to start with recalls here. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration citing tens of thousands of recalls related to failing seat anchors. What can you tell us about how common recalls are?
Yeah, sure. So all car seat manufacturers create a card that comes with their car seats to have families fill out, that then if something were to happen like a recall, if they fill it out and they send it in, they will get notified if that recall is their seat, as well as, you know, as you said, there's lots of recalls that come down. So seats are tested to meet standards, but at times when things go wrong, there are some voluntary recalls that get pushed out to families that can then help get the parts and pieces of their car seats that don't work well and sent in for some new ones or some updated pieces if this is something that needs to be stopped getting used. So if their seats cannot no longer be used. And so families can find out if it's their seats if they go to www.nhtsa.gov/recalls to find out more if that is their seat.
So be always aware and kind of proactive with this. This falls along, I kind of think, the same lines. Like, car seats have expiration dates, and I've always kind of found that so curious, especially, you know, as a parent of multiples, we wanted to reuse and pass things down, and that's more difficult with car seats. Why do car seats have an expiration date?
Yeah, so all car seats have an expiration date because when you kind of think of just general wear and tear, seats get old and kids are jumping in them and you're moving around and you're installing them in different vehicles, and just the integrity of that seat just kind of is not the same as what it used to be. And so that is why car seat manufacturers like to put an end date on when that car seat can hold up to the same standards of when they first crash tested that model and that seat.
Okay, so it's making sure that there is the latest equipment on that seat and when it was last tested, which is then related to its expiration date.
Yeah, so it helps make sure, like, you know, if you have a seat that's sitting in a hot car, and, it, you know, in Wisconsin, sometimes we can get some really hot temperatures, and if it's sitting in the hot sun, when you think of some of those, like, plastics, they can get warped and out of place. And so after a certain amount of time, those car seat manufacturers like to say that typically the seat might not hold up to the same standard that it once did before.
We hear of some really awful accidents where children are seriously injured or worse. Can you walk us through the stages of child safety restraints and when a child is ready for the next step?
Of course. And so there are lots of different types and models of car seats. And so really what we like to look at is rear facing, where their face is facing the back of the car, and then forward facing. And so when you're looking at that rear facing mode for Wisconsin law, it's typically 1 year old and 20 pounds. However, we like to promote best practice, which is usually at least the age of two. And then also looking at that car seat's maximum height and weight requirements before you would be turning them forward facing. And then when you are turning them forward facing in a 5-point harness, so that means that they have five different connections. It's kind of like that typical harness that you see. We like to typically look at 4 years old and 40 pounds. But again, we say best practice would be to max out that height and weight for that seat. And so a lot of times it's like looking at, oh, it goes up to 50 pounds or 65 pounds and looking to make sure that their ears are below the top of the shell for lots of seats. It just kind of depends on what that seat requires, but we like to look at those maximums so you're keeping them in longer. And then there's one more stage before you're going to just a seatbelt, and that's your booster. Mm. And so your booster likes to just pump, push them up a little bit higher so that seatbelt really hits in the correct spots. And you're looking for Wisconsin law, that would be 8 years old or 80 pounds or 5 feet 9 inches. But best practice we say is something called the 5-step test, which is something that can be found on our childrenswi.org/car seat page that talks about making sure that that seat belt in the car is in the middle of their shoulder, resting in the middle of their chest, and that the lap portion is over their hip bones and not the stomach.
Do you find that parents move their child to the next stage too quickly in car seats and in boosters? Because once you turn them around, it's like it changes their vantage point in a huge way. And that is a big step.
It is. It is a really big step. And we do find that families are often ready to move their kids on to the next stages. And a lot of times if their friends are doing it, then they want to do it too. So there's sometimes that peer pressure from the kids. But, you know, kids grow at all different stages. And so we say, you know, really waiting until they hit that 5-step test to be out of the booster is really that best for those crash dynamics to make sure that they're safest in the car.
There are statistics that say that car seats are installed wrong a lot of the time. What common mistakes do people make when installing them?
So with car seats, there is never just really one straight way to install a car seat. You know, you were talking about that recall before had stuff to do with their lower anchors. And that is something that is one way that you can install a car seat, but it has some different regulations around weight. And then there's another version, which is the seatbelt. And just because there are so many different ways to install a seat, that's kind of where we land on some of those mistakes. And so there's people that use both the lower anchors and the seatbelt, and lots of times car seats only want one. Sometimes parents and caregivers forget to lock the seatbelt. It just, you know, there's so many different pieces. It's sometimes hard to remember every single way to make sure that it's completely correct.
I always think about, I mean, you just crank on that car seat to get it into those anchors. And I'm just like, you got to just let go that the back seat will ever look the same again in terms of the cushion. You know, you just got to let it go. Like your back seat is now a car seat venue. It is not about the aesthetics of the contour of your back seat.
Yeah, it is. It's like you have to get a pretty tight install. You know, we don't want that seat wiggling more than an inch side to side or front to back. And so that's kind of our general rule of thumb, is we like to tug on the seat and show the families how for that. But yeah, it definitely is pretty tight in there. And, you know, once kids are back there, you get all their snacks and all of those pieces that kind of change your back seat look forever.
What about winter gear? Because you want to bundle them up, and yet that can also impede the safety of the car seat. What do you suggest there with coats?
Yeah, so we like to say you really want those thin layers. And so something like a light fleece or something that you can layer on that doesn't add too much extra in between the child and that harness. So we have a puffy coat sheet on the same website that I mentioned before, childrenswi.org/car seat, that just kind of talks about the general rule of thumb of what to look for. And what we really like for the family to try, if they're curious to see if the coat is too thick, is to put the kid in the coat, put them into the car, tighten it as they would, which you want to make sure that you can't pinch that harness. That's how you know that it's tight enough. And if you take them out without loosening that harness, and then you put them back in without that coat, if there's any extra slack in that harness where you can actually pinch it, then you would notice that it is too puffy of a coat to be putting your child in before you harness them in. Instead, if you can harness them in, put some blankets on them, put some layers over the harness with the hat and some gloves, to keep them snuggled in for the ride.
That's a great experiment there. It's Car Seat Safety from Children's Wisconsin, which runs a comprehensive car seat program as part of its Safety Center program managed by Macy Williams. Colin, with your questions, your experiences with car seats, booster seats, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get advice on car seat safety and help with questions about installing car seats correctly and booster seats. Still time to ask your questions about child passenger safety and buckling up little ones. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Macy Williams with us, Safety Center Program Manager at Children's Wisconsin. Macy, let's look at state law versus, more stringent safety practices, because it seems like there's a bit of a disconnect there. How do our state laws compare to what, safety professionals, injury prevention professionals, and doctors say?
Yeah, so we typically like to look for a little bit more, some longer years that the child should be in a car seat. And so, I mentioned previously that like rear facing the law just is 1 year old and 20 pounds. When you think of a 1 year old that's 20 pounds, they're actually quite small still. And so realistically, we like to have them in those seats longer. And so that's why we would really like to look at best practice and would really like to look for legislation to slowly move towards having some stricter laws that allow for those children to be in those child restraints longer, just to help make sure that we're keeping them in the safest way possible when they're traveling in the car.
And why is a rear facing position a better situation in a crash for those littlest ones?
So when you think of a baby and you think of their neck and torso control, and they don't have the same muscle development, they don't have the same bone development that the rest of us do when we're sitting and growing. And so they don't have the same strength behind to keep their head in a nice, safe location when there's in a crash. And there's so much force in a crash that everyone kind of gets thrown around. And keeping them in the rear-facing mode, how the seat cradles them in the crash is the best for, when you think of just basic like whiplash, just some of those pieces for their head and their neck. It's just the safest.
There's one safety group that says children shouldn't sit in the front seat until age 13. Let's look at a little bit of the older age group, if you will. How do we know when that time is right?
Yeah. And so that's kind of looking more at those boosters. And so that is kind of when you look at to make sure that that seatbelt in your car is really hitting those kids in the right spots. So when you are looking and they're sitting with their seatbelt, if that lower lap portion is on their belly in any way that is not where it should be in a crash, it will then really basically smush all of their soft area. And that can be a risk in a crash. And so you really want to make sure that when you're having them in a seatbelt, that it is hitting them at some of those harder points in their body. So their hip bones, and you want it in the middle of their shoulder, not on their neck. And when you're looking at moving them to the front seat, that's a lot at looking at those airbags. So airbags are tested against adult proportions. And that's kind of why they give the general rule of thumb of that 13 years old. We really want them looking and having some more of those adult like characteristics in their body, so that when an airbag, if it were to be deployed, it doesn't, completely smush them the same ways that it might if it was a child.
We're talking about child passenger safety, car seat safety as well. Macy Williams here, program manager of Children's Wisconsin Safety Center. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Macy, car seats can cost hundreds of dollars. What resources are available to help lower the cost of car seats?
Sure. So it just kind of depends where you're located in the state for the different resources that are available. Children's Wisconsin is one of the people that does help offer some resources around the Milwaukee area. And so there is a low-cost car seat distribution service for those children's patients that are looking and need some support with car seats. And then when you're looking and turning it statewide, safekidswi.org is a good site to look at some different car seat fitting stations, which can help you at least get your car seat fit and appropriately sized for your child statewide. And then at times there are some other options to help get those resources out and to find for some support with car seats.
Do you have any tips on how to properly clean a car seat? Because they don't get dirty at all. Never.
Right? They get
not
disgusting.
A Cheerio in sight.
Definitely. So every manufacturer of just how you install those car seats, everything is different in how they want them cleaned. So really it's reading those manuals or looking on those manufacturing websites for how to take off that cover and make sure that you clean them gently and not using anything that's too harsh. Typically, a lot of the times it's like, you know, some warm water and a rag, and that's how you can wipe down some of those harness straps when they get really gross from, you know, juice spilling and all of that.
How can we adults be better role models with car seats? How can we emulate what habits we want our child to develop?
Yeah, that's, you know, really great. Children really watch what their caregivers are doing in front of them. So just wearing that car seat and emphasizing when you're putting them in the seat that, like, you know, this is really safe. This is really, you know, something that we're doing to protect you, and just being that role model in the car of every time when they're buckling up, you're buckling up, so that it, you know, is something that everyone is making commitment to do in the car.
Macy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Macy Williams is Safety Center Program Manager at Children's Wisconsin. We have a link to their Safety Center. It's at WPR.org/mornings. And for disclosure, Children's Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.